Okay, well, thank you for coming back if you've come back. If you've not come back, then thank you for coming. That makes perfect sense. Plenty of hardware, lots of demos, nerves of steel. It's never gone wrong before, right? It's a bit like when you go to a... People go to Speedway to see car crashes. That's what they do, apparently. They go, boom, bang. That's why you're all here. No. I'm thinking back to last year's Connect demo, which is still seared in my mind and will stay there forever. So I've got a fair few demos this time. What I'm going to do is talk for about 75 minutes, but it'll seem an awful lot longer. Okay. I have a few more emergency jokes, which I'm hoping I won't need this time because everything's been tested. The only thing that is interesting is that the USB drivers for the gadgeteer that I'm using have a habit of blue screening my machine. So if that happens, it's not my fault, okay? So the machine goes bip and blue screens, and it's nothing to do with me, really. But it should be fine, although having said that, it probably won't be now. And basically, we're looking at gadgets, looking at making gadgets, what makes a gadget, how you make computers for gadgets, outside world interfacing, printing boxes, which is always a good thing to do, and then how to make your own gadgets and roll their own containers. And so we're going to work our way through this. I've got some bits and pieces, some demos and some toys, and even a prize about halfway through. There's a prize. People like prizes. Jolly good. So you're all interested now. That's great. So what's a gadget? Well, there you go. There's Inspector Gadget. The human race is all about gadgets, really. I'm sure that when the first plow was invented, someone invented the other plow, and they used to sort of compare them and talk in the pub about whose plow was better. Do you know that the first telephone was invented in 1790, but the second telephone wasn't invented until 10 years later? He said, ruining the gag. So you have to have two telephones, otherwise there's no point. Okay, right, fine. Okay. So let's make one. Someone goes, let's make two, even better. Then we can wire them up. We've been surrounding ourselves with gadgets forever and ever and ever. And this is one which I haven't got one of these, but my daughter's got one of these, and she's very proud of it. You put an apple on the... Oh, my little LED light isn't very good. There it is. I'll point it where the spot's pointing at. Does that help? My daughter's got one of these, and basically you put the apple on there, and you turn the handle, and this thing cuts all the peel off in one long stringy thing, and it sort of cuts into slices and cores it all in one. And apparently this kind of thing would impress a Victorian, because that's kind of what they had. And so they'd make really impressive gadgets like the Flying Scotsman train and bridges and things, because that's what they did. These days, most gadgets that we're talking about that are interesting have an electronic component. One of the things that you hear said a lot these days, we talk about embedded devices, and we're becoming surrounded by these. And you can sort of, the definition of them is kind of interesting, because you start off, okay, this mouse is an embedded device, because inside here is a microcontroller which is reading the position of the reflection of the laser LED, and then pushing it through a Bluetooth stack into my laptop here. And so this is an embedded device which is controlled by a computer. So is a picture frame. You put your SD card in, and then it loads up all the pictures and shows you them. But then your SD card gets cleverer, and we start loading apps into it, and it starts running programs. And at that point, it drifts away from being embedded and starts to turn into a proper computer. What I want to try and talk about in terms of this chat is basically we're looking at simple, single-purpose devices. In other words, you turn the power on, and it does that job, and that's it. These things are cheap, single-purpose, and you can write C-sharp programs to control them. And that's kind of where I'm going with this. So we're looking at embedded devices that are basically single-purpose, built for a job. In the olden days, you really were. If you're making one based around a pick, or a 6809 or 6301 or whatever. Tiny, tiny chips, 8085. These were great fun to work with, but they were all programmed in machine code, or if you were lucky, C, and they were fairly horrible to work with. But now we can leave all that aside because we can now use the skills we've got in C Sharp and Visual Studio to make gadgets. Now, how many C Sharp have we got in? How many C Sharp guys have we got in? VB? Yeah. Visual, one hand went up. What a... I'm saying nothing. I'm going to move on. Basically, if you've got C Sharp or VB Smarts and you know Visual Studio, you can go home. I've used this line before, and it's still true. You can go home and now update your CV and call yourself an embedded developer. Because using the tools that I'm going to show you and the platforms that we've got lying around now, you are. You can make embedded devices. And there is actually a good place to put these. There is a way. There is actually a niche into which you can put this skill. And you can have fun, which is kind of nice. And you can build things and play with them. But you can also, there's also kind of places you can put this tech, which makes it really useful. And I'll explore some of that a bit further down. So this is not, it starts off as fun. Then it gets serious when you find a proper use for it. And then away you go from there. So we're doing it in C Sharp, and we're using the .NET Micro Framer, which has been around for a surprisingly long time in various incarnations. If you haven't, how many folk here know about .NET Micro Framework? Okay, a goodly percentage. That's nice, about 40% or so. How many bought my book? No hands go up. That's what I thought, yes. That agrees with the metrics that I got back from the publishers. I should have given some crayons away with it. That would have helped. Whatever. The Micro Framework is basically, it's an engine that runs C-sharp compiled bytecodes. So you take your, the way that .NET runs programs is that your C-sharp compiler compiles down to MSIL, which is the intermediate language. And then inside the target, that gets just-in-time compiled, jitted into machine code that runs. That's what happens on your PC when you fire up a compiled C-sharp program. And on the .NET Micro Framework, it's subtly different because the idea is that rather than actually compiling it and jitting it, what the Micro Framework does is it actually interprets the code. So it's a bit slower, but it can run in teeny, tiny devices. And so the idea is that we take .NET and we spread it. We start off with the PC and the tablet, the ultrabook and the desktop. And these things are high-end boxes running operating systems of considerable size and complexity. You consume lots of power. They're very powerful and they're extremely useful as a general-purpose device. Then you take your Windows core and you make Windows 8 embedded or Windows 7 embedded. And now you've got the Windows operating system fundamentals running inside an embedded device. If you ever see them in the car park where I park the car each Saturday, one day I saw them with the door off the ticket machine, and inside was an IBM PC sitting on a rack with a wire coming out to the machine and the printer, and that was it. So these things are Tesco's tills, are quite often embedded PCs. And these are, well, they're leveraging the fact that it's cheap and quick to write applications on a PC platform, and they're putting that platform into devices like these. If you go down the next level, looking at Windows Embedded, and so now you have Windows CE, which is a specifically designed operating system that runs underneath applications, provides hard real time, and a really good platform to make not just embedded devices, but multi-purpose ones as well. And finally, right at the very right-hand side on the edgy edge, you've got the .NET Micro Framework. Now, this is specifically for embedded devices, okay? The interesting thing about all these devices, you can't see my dot, but it's moving about, I promise. I'm going to get a bigger dot next year, my God. I won't get it through customs, but by gum, it'll be impressive. We burn a big hole. Actually, apparently on PowerPoint 2013, you've got a little dot you can move around like a laser pointer, but I've not got that because our university's email won't work with... anyway, I digress. You don't want to hear my personal... you probably do, actually. Down the far end, you've got single-purpose devices, but you're writing C-sharp, you're debugging in Visual Studio, using all the tools you've already got. You're single-stepping through code. You're putting in breakpoints. You're examining variables. You're doing all that good stuff across all these platforms. And you're also using connected devices. These things are inherently connected now. And one of the things about the micro framework that's really important that you keep in mind is you might think, ooh, TV remote control, that'll work a treat. Yes, it will. But what you could do is you can put whatever you like in there to network it. You can put a Wi-Fi chip in there so that it actually tracks what people do with it. You can make these things extremely connected because on the micro framework, you've still got the full network stack. So that means that you can push off web queries. You can bring back XML and play with it. You can upload stuff and bring things down. You can plug it into the cloud. All that stuff just works. And you don't have to learn any new APIs to make it work in the embedded device because you already know them. They're all baked in to the framework that you've actually used. In the case of the micro framework, and this is kind of impressive, there is no operating system. Windows CE, Windows XP, Windows 8, whatever, they all sit underneath your program and provide a rich environment for it to run in. In the case of micro framework, we don't have that. The program wakes up and it runs. We never change the program for a different one. The program can still do things like thread.sleep. The program can still do all the stuff you would like it to do. We've got collections. We've got floating point types. We've got all that good stuff. But it's not handled by the OS as such. It just calls through to a very thin layer of executive. So basically, the OS is everything we stick behind the APIs to make them go. And that's it. In terms of multitasking, we've got that. But we haven't got hard real-time scheduling. We've got round-robin multitasking. So basically, the processor will arbitrate between the executable candidates, the threads, at any given time on a round-robin basis. So unlike CE, where you get hard real-time, in .NET Micro Framework, you don't get that. You basically get best efforts. So if you want to respond to something within 50 milliseconds of it happening, then Micro Framework might not be the best bet for you. There is a caveat, which is if you want to, you can get hold of a micro framework, make a custom build, and put your own embedded C in there to get your real-time behavior that way. And the second thing which I've noticed is that for the bulk of applications that you use the micro framework for, hard real-time is not what you're after. As long as it happens in a reasonable... The remote control is a case in point. If it takes an extra 10 milliseconds to respond to my button press, I'm not going to notice. And it does things with the interrupts and the events, like timestamping them. I've got students at the moment in our second year course using micro framework, and we have a robot, and we have a controller, and we have an infrared connection between the two. And basically the controller turns infrared on, sleeps for 50 milliseconds, and turns it off. And the robot is listening for edge-triggered interrupts. So when it sees the start of the pulse, it gets an interrupt. When it sees the end of the pulse, it gets another one. These interrupts are not hard real time, but they're time stamped with ticks. So what I can do is basically I can subtract the time I saw the rising edge from the time I saw the falling edge, and we're getting accuracies to a millisecond on that. So although we're not getting the event response in real time, the important stuff like when the pulse actually happened, that's done in machine code, that's done in real time, that's done properly. And so there's lots of scope for doing real time stuff, and the performance is pretty darn good, but it's not, I can't put my hand on my heart and say it's hard real time. The good news, as I say, is you're writing C sharp, you're using .NET, and it's running inside a device the size of your thumbnail. In fact, I have got some very small devices I haven't brought with me because the postman, they're stuck in the post office, I must go and get them. They're basically about the size of a large postage stamp. And you can drop this thing into a circuit, plug it in, attach your devices, attach the compiler and the debugger via a serial port or USB, and you can drop C sharp into it and it runs. And I love that. That's really nice. And so the number of devices you can target is really large, and the fun you can have is kind of extreme. Like I said, C sharp is normally compiled to MSIL and then pushed into whatever target you're using. In the case of micro framework, we compress the IL, and we drop it into the machine as bytecodes, and it then interprets them. So it's just, it runs like BASIC used to in the old days. Find the line, do what it says, onto the next line, do what it says, onto the next line, do what it says. The hit is performance. It's a bit slow compared to native machine code. But again, we don't care, because the kind of things we're talking about don't need huge amounts of grunt. As soon as the power comes on, the machine wakes up and runs whatever's in there. So you download this thing, you burn it into the EEPROM, and at that point, you've got a device that does that job. And that's it. Not all devices, you don't get everything on all the devices. It's a limitation of some platforms have other all the bits, some platforms have extra bits, but the fundamentals are present on everything. So you've got a solid place you can write good real-time stuff. You've got a WPF-like display mechanism. You've got all the objects, but none of the XAML, if put it that way. You can create objects on the fly and set properties and position them and use stack panels and all that kind of good stuff. But rather than writing it in XAML, you write it out in code and you make the objects and bind them into the canvases and things yourself by hand. It's not particularly hard, and it's a lot easier than having to recalculate where everything is when you get a new display screen with a different size. So all that stuff comes out in the wash. And there's lots of special purpose stuff too. And when we come on to Gadgeteer in a minute or two, that's when that gets really interesting. So here we go. The way it works is lovely. It's really nice. Effectively, everything that you talk to in the outside world is an object. And so I make an object instance, and I then twiddle with that. Just like a stream links you to a file, an input port links you to a pin. And so this is my code that reads a pin. I'm going to use pin number 2 because that's the one that's wired to the pin on my particular platform. So I make an input port instance, which I've called switch input. I've tied it to this particular pin. I've said I don't want a glitch filter. Anyone know what a glitch filter is? It's a filter for glitches. Someone's going, yup, proper engineer. Yup, I do know. Ha ha ha. When you're pressing buttons on remote controls and stuff, you're actually pushing a piece of carbon across two bits of copper. And as it comes down and lands, you might get transients on the edge that cause spikes and pulses in the signal. If you don't filter those out, they can cause the computer to become confused and see more button presses than you're after. And so we have a glitch filter we can turn on or off when we make an input port. The pull-up resistor is again an internal resistance that sets the actual signal default state to either high or low, depending on how you've wired your switch up. Now, this is low level. This is far lower than you have to go, but I like showing this code because it gives you an idea of the fundamentals. So if you want to just read pins and things, make myself a pin, read it. If it's true, then there's a signal there. If it's false, there isn't one. And we've got a whole gamut of different devices, input pins, output pins, interrupt pins, serial ports, pulse width modulation, so you can do motor control and all that good stuff, and it all just works. If you want graphical displays, you can do that. You can work with bitmaps. You can put shapes, images, and text and all that kind of stuff on there, or you can use WPF, but you have to, as I've said, roll your own objects, which is fine. And I've done this, and it works very well. And so you've got quite a lot of power in a little tiny box, and that's really rather nice. The thing about microframing is at that point you could stop, and that's where you'd be about 2 years ago. So 2 years ago I would say, yes, you can read a pin and make a light bulb come on. It's quite impressive because you write the code that does this, and people go, whoa, that's amazing. But every night they go home and just do it. And they aren't impressed by that one. It's nothing like adding a computer to make things more impressive. So a year or so ago, that's kind of where we were. And then Gadgeteer came along. And Gadgeteer is awesome. Gadgeteer is really nice. That's a Gadgeteer board. This is the top of it. And you can see that it's a CPU board with a whole bunch of little sockets, each of which are labeled with letters and numbered so you can find them. That's number 4, number 6, number whatever. And there's a whole bunch of these. And that's just the front side. There's also a reset button and a bit of configuration, which makes it all go. If I turn the chip over, then this is what I see. This is my micro framework device. They aren't actually this size. They're a lot smaller. Okay. Oh, I so want one that big now. Here we go. It's wonderful. This is the bit that does the work. You see, there's several different ways you can use this. The actual device itself, if you want to see one, I've actually got one along here. This is the Gadgeteer board. And so that's the actual, this is quite a large one. But there's the board in real life. There's the processor. On the flip side, there's the sockets. Now, one of the things you would probably use this for, and one way it's intended to be used, is this is what I show the venture capitalist to get that 2 million quid of backing. And then when I've got my 2 million quid, I'll either disappear, which should be lovely, or I'll get a custom board made up, which has got just the connections that I need for the devices that I'm using, and I'll transplant this board from my gadgeteer board onto a custom board I'll have made in China or somewhere, much cheaper, with just the bits that I need, and I'll ship the product based on that. So you've got lots of flexibility. As it is, effectively, you've got a little microprocessor which I can push C# programs into and run, and that's the RAM, that's the processor, this stuff here around the side is the glue, and it brings out, it's called glue logic. It is really, honestly, it is. Would I lie to you if I didn't have to? They expose tons of pins, and the Gadgeteer framework packages them up into these multi-way connectors. And each of the sockets has a particular repertoire of functions. Some are serial ports, some are analog ports, some are digital, some are USB, blah, blah, blah. And so I've got this gadget based design, and I can effectively construct things out of this. I've got loads of connections. Power goes into this one, and then I can plug in 12 or 13 other connections to get the thing going. And there's a whole range of different variations of these kind of boards. This is called a Fez Spider, and it's one of the larger ones. You can get very tiny ones with only 4 or 5 connectors. You can get some with just 2 or 3. If you have a .NET MicroFramework board of your own, you can actually make your own connections up yourself if you want to. The whole thing is open. Everything is open source. The board layout, the pinouts, the chippery, the low level, the actual MicroFramework itself is all open source now. So you can download the framework for free, and you can make your own embedded device based on this technology, and there's no licensing costs in terms of using it. So it's very nice to use, and it costs you nothing to actually make your own devices. But some companies like GHI and Seed and Cytec will sell you ready-made boards. The cheapest one's about £25-30, and they go up from there. The Spider is about £50, I think, in the UK to buy, or you can buy it in kits as well. So once we've got our gadget, we have our thing in the middle. What we now have to do is actually use Visual Studio to design how our thing fits together. And this is, again, really nice. I pick my gadgeteer board, I pick my push button, I pick my camera, and I pick my TFT display, and Visual Studio design surface shows me how to wire them all up. And it basically, then I just copy the connections in the box, and then when I've got those connections, off we go. I can show you this. It's actually very, very easy to do. If I go back to my desktop and I fire up Visual Studio, I'm using the Express version, not because I can't afford the real one, but I want to show you that everything in the tool chain is free. So I've not paid for any of the software I'm using to build this. So I fire up Express. When I got Express going, I went onto the GHI website, and I downloaded the .NET Micro framework and the Gadgeteer framework. And so I've got some extra project types. I've also got Mono Games. Anyone hear about Mono Game? If you like XNA, Mono Game is the business. It's brilliant. But I digress, okay? Micro framework, Gadgeteer, Mono Game. So here we go. I can make version 4.2 or version 4.1. Let's go for 4.2. So make myself a project. We'll just call it Silly Demo. No, we won't. We won't do that, because that would be, let's call it Sensible Demo. Okay, that's much more, or Esteemed Demo. Right, so fire it up. Now, I've got my studio environment. It's all rattling away. And so this is my design surface. And so here I've got my processor board. This is a Fez Spider, which is the one I'm using, which is kind of nice. Go into the toolbox and say, I fancy using a camera. Let's pick a camera from the list. So I'll go find camera, and I'll use which one shall I go for? There's a whole bunch of different ones. Can't find it. I've got the wrong glasses on. Camera premium. Let's drag you across and drop you. And so now a camera will appear. There it is. And now I can basically say, okay, if you wouldn't mind, just connect that. He says, okay, you can put the camera into socket number 3. Then I'll go and find myself a display. How about one of those? And drag that across. And there's my display. And now I say, okay, keep on connecting. So that tells me, okay, I want the display to go into those sockets. And now I want a push button. Let's go get a push button, which is at the top there, button. Drag that on, drop it. And again, do the connect thing. And so that's it. I've now got a camera which I have built from scratch. And all I have to do now is take my physical device and replicate those connections on there. Now, I happen to have one I prepared already because it's a bit quicker that way. And I'm just checking that it all agrees, because if it's wrong, it'll all go horribly badly wrong. So that's all good. And I've got my push button is on socket number 11, and my camera is on socket number 3. Yes, it is. So I've made myself a camera. This is the thing effectively in prototype form. And what I can do is I can plug this in, and the machine will blue screen. Watch carefully. It had better not. So that's my system firing up. Okay, so how do I actually make the camera take photographs? Well, if I go into my program file down here, then the way the micro framework works, when the program starts running, we get a method called program started. And that basically says, okay, when you get a reset, this is when you put in your behaviors to make the system actually go. And it's a bit like form.loaded or on navigated to. We get control when the system fires up. And so what I have to do is, well, what I want to do is when someone presses the button, I want to take a photograph. So I find my button and I just go like this. And you can figure it out from button pressed plus equal, okay, try it again, plus equals tab. And now I've got a method which will run when the button is pressed, okay? And it's that easy. It's just, you know, I've just gone, okay, bind it, IntelliSense kicks in, drop it through. So now when I press that button on the socket, I get a button pressed event. At the moment, doesn't do anything. That's fine. But I can actually ask the camera to take a picture. And so the camera will now fire up and take a photograph. And that's all fine and dandy. So now the camera is being sent a command, hey, give me a photograph. And now what I want to do, when the camera's finished getting the picture, I want to display it. So in here I go, camera, camera, dot, picture captured, the event, bind a handler to that, tab. And so now, when the picture's been processed, I'll get this method here fired. And so now all I have to do is display it. So I go LCD. Oh, no, it's, what is it? Is it display? What's it called? I have to go back and look. I forget these things. It's called display. Right, okay. So I go display T35 dot. Now, I'm going to be using the simple graphics because I don't want to use anything particularly fancy. And I want to go simple graphics, and we'll just display an image. And what we'll do is we'll get the image from the picture. So I'll ask the picture to give me the bitmap, and then I'll place it at 0, 0 on the screen. And I'll take away that exception because that would not go well. And that's it. I've just made a push-button camera. If I fire this up, if it doesn't work, it's because the pins are in the wrong plug. But it should go just fine. What could possibly... So now, hit the go button. Studio compiles it, links it, builds it, finds the device, and then pushes that C-sharp code into the device. So what's happening now is it's actually rebooting the device, putting the thing into it, and in a minute it'll start running. And at that point, things get interesting stroke scary. So now it's all in there, it's going, we're happy, the screen's gone black. What I can do now is press the button. I'll point the camera at you lot first. So there you go. Press the button and wait a few seconds and... Yeah, it's a bit overexposed. Well, it's a lot overexposed, okay? But if I press the button again, if I point it at me, hello, then that's what you get. I've got like a... Has to make it, but it is actually taking pictures. If you don't believe me, see, what you can do is I can put a breakpoint in to the code, And because it's .NET, and because it's C#, and because it's wonderful, I can do all this while the code's still live in the device. Hit the button now, and of course I hit the breakpoint, because that's what that breakpoint does. So the great thing about this is I'm actually debugging the code in the device, in C#, using Studio. It's just like working at home, but I'm targeting this thing. And when I've finished, I can unplug the computer, plug a power supply into here, and I have my embedded device, and that's it. If you want to sort of go through the chapter and verse, then this is the code that responds to the button pressed, and this is the code that responds to the picture captured. There are other events these things can produce. You can get an event fire when the button goes down, an event fire when the button comes up, so you can detect that kind of stuff, and there's stuff the camera will do for you as well. When we get the pressed event, we take a photograph. When we get the return thing, we display a picture. And it is as simple as that. We've made ourselves a digital camera. If you go down to the Gadgeteer component library, you find there's a Gadgeteer component for SD card, Wi-Fi, network connectivity, and all kinds of stuff. So you could capture the pictures and store them somewhere. We could make a self timer that waits a few seconds. We could make the camera take a sequence of shots, and we could display them on the screen, that the user pick the best one. This, by the way, is a touch screen. So if I want to get touch events from here, I just bind to the events it generates, and then I can effectively do what I like in terms of drawing on that. So I can take multiple pictures and combine them. I can do all kinds of stuff. A slight word of warning, this processor, not massively powerful. You can't do things like image processing on the fly. You could do simple image recognition if you hammer the resolution down a bit, but it's not got the kind of grunt that you would have from a proper machine code running device. But it's good enough to be useful, and that's all you really want. I've already shown you the demo. There's that guy again. I don't know who. Anyone know him? Because he's kind of famous. He came in the template, and he's going to be there forever now. I hope he's getting royalties, but anyway, I digress. If he stands up now and says, want to make something of it, I'm in trouble, but we'll keep going. There's lots of ways we could make the camera more interesting. I was playing with this. one of the more recent... let's make a camera that only Robert can use. So I go into my box of bits, and I dig out this thing, which is one of the more recent... This thing reads RFID tags, so you can actually just wave your tag in front of this. And so what we do is we effectively go back to my program. There it is. Stop it. Get my mouse back so I can stop it. Go back to my Gadgeteer design surface, and I'll pull out an RFID reader. So if I just drift down here, and I can find RFID. There it is. Drag that onto the display and drop it. And it's around somewhere. There it is. Now I just say, OK, connect all modules, where you're going to go. I'm going to plug you into socket 9. So get my cable, plug it into socket 9, which is this one here, and get it right way round. Of course, you can plug these things in while the power's on, Rob. Nothing bad's going to happen. That's all perfectly fine. So that's now sitting in socket 9. And I go back to my code. And so now I can drop into here. And let's see. And again, I don't bother reading the manuals on these devices. I just use IntelliSense. So I go RFID dot. I don't tell my students to do this, by the way. I tell them to read the manuals and learn about it. But they've got to learn about hypocrisy sometime in their life. And so I go like that, card data received, plus equals, tab, tab. And so now this will fire when I put a RFID tag on top of there. What I'm going to do is just this time, I'm going to put a breakpoint in because I want to see what value is actually inside. Well, no, I'll go like this. Better yet. One thing you can do is you can go debug, if you can type that is, debug.print ID, like that. And I'll put a breakpoint on that. Well, I'll leave it. Actually, that's fine. So that's going to print the thing out. If I make this a bit bigger so you can see more easily at the back, there you go. So now when the card reader detects an RFID tag, I'll get that event fired, run the program up again. It's now building a new version of the app, deploying it down the USB to the target device, which will be reset in a minute. If you get stuck at this point, oh no, here we go, we're all good. Now it's resetting, dee-dee-dee. And so if I go and find, I got these RFID tags from eBay. £25 for 100. So I now have 100 of these, which, well, you know, it's quite, I'm a man with 100 RF. Can you say that? Have you got 100 RFID? Well, have you? Well, I'm going to use it. I'm doing a lecture in Rhyme for Comic Relief a week tomorrow, in fact, about the Gadgeteer framework. And I'm going to sell these to students at £2 each. And one of them will be the lucky RFID tag, which they wave across, and that one wins the prize. That's the idea. Basically, it'll be a line that says, "Print line, you have lost." That's how we're. But that's my plan with these. So I'm going to be doing a bit of value added. Actually, if I get more than £1,000 sponsored on the Red Nose Day thing, I will do it wearing a tutu. The students are really keen on this, and they're suggesting pink and spangly, but I want to see the money first, and then we'll talk about it. Back to the plot. My code is now inside the device running. If I open up the output window, there it is. Then if I wave this tag across there, then out comes the number on the RFID. And this is number 07 blah, 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 blah. So I'll basically grab hold of that and copy it. Then I'll stop the program, and I'm going to go, it was this one, wasn't it? I'm going to go, so if ID equals equals, double quote, that thing. This might not work because there's a possible issue with hidden characters coming back from the reader. At that point, I could now trigger my camera, so I'll just go camera.takePicture again. Take picture. Boink. So now, if I use this tag and this tag only, it will take a photograph. I'll put a breakpoint here to prove it works, then we'll run it up. So now I've got an RFID tag-enabled device. So if you want to log people or track them or find out what they're doing, give them these, 25p each, let them wander around and wave the things over the top. It's not directly relevant, but it's kind of related. Anyone play with NFC tags on Windows Phone? They are so cool. You get a whole bunch of them, and you can, there's a Nokia program that lets you design the tags and what they do, and you can start music off by just touching it. It's just so sweet. Anyway, are we going? We're going, that's good. So if I wave you over there, then it's hitting the breakpoint, so that means that we're actually in business. So if I run the program on that, it will take a picture, and the picture will come up on the screen. There it is. Not a very good picture, but it is a picture. If I use a different tag, say this one, then light flashes. No picture is taken, so now I've got a camera that only works for Robert, because it won't work with that tag, but it will work with that one. Bang. So, I mean, this is all silly stuff, but if you've got a problem at your workplace where you're tracking people or resources or objects or items or anything, and you want a quick way to build a prototype to prove it works, and keep remembering this stuff is network connected. So I can put a Wi-Fi receiver on there, a transmitter on there, so that I can do this logging and push it up into the cloud and bring stuff back. I can use an output from here. You can get output modules, relay modules, so I can control locks and machinery and bits and pieces and drive those from my C# directly as well. So it's all lots and lots of potential for really good stuff. Let that run on, and we'll go back to the deck. So if I want to, I can make my camera more interesting. I can make it so that only I can use it. That's the RFID tag reader. What I really want that isn't available yet is an NFC tag reader. Then I'm going to have some serious fun. So I'm trying to reprogram. Anyway, yes. The first thing I said to a guy at work that uses these as well, can you spoof these? And the answer is yes. You can spoof the RFID in here quite easily, apparently. People in China will do it for you, in fact, which is nice of them. So there you go. The reader goes into a socket. We make ourselves one. We bind to the event. We check for a particular magic number. If we see that, we take a picture. That's it. So now I have a card control, and there's that man again. Hello. Gosh, if the thing is that if any of you guys actually meet him, you're going to have hysterics, and he won't know why. Okay, I hope it's a stock photo, because if that's the case, he's been paid for it, and that's okay. He deserves what he gets. So there's lots of fun. Like I said, if this is 20p and I'm flogging it for 2 quid, I am turning a profit. And the students will like it because it's a thing of, looks like it's mildly valuable. It's actually, you know, it's more fun than a raffle. So we're going to have a play with that. I've got some issues to address, like if I flog 100 of these, we have to find the winner. How do we do it? I've only got one reader. I wanted to use it in lectures. So when students come to lectures, they have to sort of do that before they can come in, you see, and then we can track them and see how many's come up. But what would happen is after about a week, there'd be one student with a big ring full of them, and he'd go... because that's how students are. Or the sharper ones would have an app on their Windows phone that went and spoofed the entire class, which would be even more annoying. But there's lots of... I mean, if you're involved in anything like this, I mean, these are on key rings. You can put them into cardboard. You can have business cards with them in. You can put them into products. You can put them on sale tags and what have you. And if you buy lots of them, they get really, really cheap. Like, really cheap. So lots of fun. The camera... Yeah, we had a camera, a button, an LCD panel, put an SD card on there, we can save pictures, put a network connection on, we can push things up. There's lots of stuff we can use, and I do mean absolutely lots. This is just part of the selection. We've got all these, and then we've got a whole bunch more, and we've got a whole bunch more. They're just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. If you look at them, that's LCD panel. Then we've got a multicolored LED, which you can use for feedback. We've got a camera, of course, wired networking. We've got a push wireless network. We've got a push button, SD card, USB host, joystick, breakout connector. You can bring the cables out and link them to your own devices, of which more in a minute or two. We've got a potentiometer for analog input. We've got a USB client. And then we've got a barometer, a CAN interface for linking to your car ignition system and reading back information from that. We've got Bluetooth, we've got GPRS phone, we've got a compass, we've got a current sensor, we've got a parallel I.O. for driving lots and lots of devices simultaneously, GPS receiver, gyroscope, input-output expansion, I.O. remote control. This one, which looks really painful, I've actually brought this along. Anyone know what it is? It's for soil moisture. You plug this into your plants, and then it gives you a resistance reading that lets you work out how wet the soil is, so you can have plant watering systems, all kinds of fun like that. I think you could probably use it as a lie detector as well, because you get this out and they go, oh my God, I'm not lying. Now plug it in. No. Then it's right any code, just get the thing out and go, all right, okay, well, get that out of a tub of Vaseline, and they'll be going, oh my God. But I digress. We've also got an LED array, which you can use to display patterns and things. I've got four of those. I could go on. They've also got a pulse oximeter, which you can use to measure your heartbeat. We did Global Game Jam at the university this year. And if you did, Global Game Jam is wonderful. Just do it. It's great fun. The theme was heartbeat. And I happened to have a pulse oximeter in my bag, as you do. well, as I do. We had a heartbeat control game driven from MicroFramework. There's also PIR detectors, temperature sensors, light sensors. You can produce VGA output. You can play music through MP3. And all of this is on the same... I mean, you can see what there is just by looking at what you get on the design surface. Because if I basically go into here, the Gadgeteer Framework toolbox, you've got all this stuff. Okay, so you've got all these different devices, stepper motor drivers, pulse drivers, music chips. These are the processor boards. That's the printer, which more in a second or two. So there's tons and tons of stuff. And they all wire in the same way, and they all are programmed the same way. So making gadgets is really, really easy. And so you can make projects that respond when the user does something like I've done, or you can fire off a timer on a thread, and the thread will run every hour, every 2 hours or whatever, or in response to events. And so we can do that kind of thing really easily. What I did at this point, just to sort of egomania, I built this device that whenever I do a tweet, it prints it out. kind of sad. So I've got a Wi-Fi chip, a Gadgeteer board, a 7 LED circular thing, which actually shows the status of the connection, and a little thermal printer. And the printer is quite interesting, because the printer is a gadget that somebody made for me, and it basically hangs off the serial port and takes stuff and prints it. Little spark from thermal printer. And I'll talk about a bit more about it in a second or two, but first, a slight digression, because digressions are always good for a giggle. The problem I have with my gadgets is they ended up looking like this, which is kind of impressive if you're making an 80s sci-fi movie, but not so much good. I mean, the problem with the case has always been a difficult thing to deal with. So what I did was I went and bought Una, and Una is an Ultimaker. Have you heard of Ultimaker? They're a Dutch company. They make the best 3D printer you can buy, I reckon, because I bought one. It's really good. Comes in kit form, and you first thing you do is paint it blue, and then you actually put it together. And it took us 2 days, and you feed in this stuff, which is continuous, like the stuff you use in your weed whacker, whatever it is, and it melts it, and it forces it onto a platform. It goes through this stepper motor, which drives it up a thing called the Bowden tube. It gets pushed into a print head where it's heated up, and then it melts and comes out of a print nozzle, which is this little bit down here. And then once you've done that, it actually extrudes onto a platform, and the platform moves down, and we do another layer, and it's 3D printing. I'm not sure that it's the future, but it is great fun. And it's a tinkerer's delight. What you do is you buy a 3D printer and then spend ages making bits for your 3D printer. So the main reason you have one is so you can print bits for it, which is kind of like the recursive nature of that. This is a fan shroud which I printed for the printer, so there you go. So it's no use. My wife is mildly impressed. She's also thinking, you know, all the good things. Yeah, and you went and bought one of those. Yes, dear, it's for work. Yes. So, yeah, and I use a program called FreeCAD. And with FreeCAD, you can basically design these units and pop it. And these are basically little carriers that will take my gadget devices. And then having done that, I actually go ahead and I print stuff. And so what I ended up with, which is, this was my, I wanted my Twitter printer to look like something. And this is supposed to be magenta, but I don't think it's magenta. It's a good thing I like pink. But this is a 3D printed box with holes in the back for the bolts to go through. Then we just bolt the components inside and screw them down. And the thing that really impressed me about this was it works by waving a nozzle around above a platform. Okay, so it's a glorified cake icing machine. Okay, that's what it is. But they're using modulation on the steppers to do micro-stepping. They're getting sub-millimeter resolution. And I just took my gadgeteer panels, and I just dropped them straight on, and they fitted, which I think is just astonishingly good. I didn't have to do any hammering or sawing. They just went straight on. The gadgeteer framework, the design of the boards is such that the pitch between the pins is actually a set standard. There's a certain 5 millimeter dot pitch, and that's... they're all based on the same grid. And you can go online to the Codeplex site for Gadgeteer, and you can download 3D models of all these components. So what you can do is you can actually design your box around the component you want to put in it, and you can do a really good sanity check. So you can know before you build the box that the pins are going to be in the right place. And that's awesomely powerful. I mean, the Gadgeteer guys have sort of looked at it and gone, yeah, 3D printing, that's coming. Folk are going to want to make their own boxes. Yes, they are. So we'll make it really easy. So you can go on, you can pull down all the 3D models, and you can make sure that it'll fit, you can get at it, the things are in the right place, and it all lines up. And so I printed this off, and it works very well. And I got myself a thermal printer, from a little SparkFun one, and printed the box for that. Same shade of pink. I have lots of pink left, actually. Actually, I quite like the pink. It's nice. And you can... you can just turn stuff out. And question, how many folk here have got a Lumiere 820? Oh, you, sir, you were the first. Okay. What I did on Thursday last week, if you've got an 820, one of the great things about the 820 is that It has removable covers, does it not? Oh, no. Right, okay. This just got interesting. Oh, shit. Okay, this is what I did on Thursday night. Nokia, in their wisdom, have released the designs for the cases for the 820. So if you have an 820, you can go online and download a STL file and make your own and print your own cases for it. And they work. Because I've got an 820, and you can print it out and just slap it on your phone. And so we now have a situation where you can effectively make your own custom cases any shape or color that you like. I thought, coming to Holland, what color would go down rather nicely in Netherlands? And so I dug out some orange PLA, and I put it there. Now, the downside is the buttons a little, maybe by a little bit, and of course you don't get your charge cover with this because it doesn't do that, or your NFC, but if anyone here, right, okay, we've got some 820 owners in the house? Okay, that's two. Right, okay, in the car park, starting handle each, last man standing. Okay, what does MSIL stand for, first one? Thank you, you have won. There you go. One condition, I want to see pictures of the phone with the case on when you get it going. And you may want to just tidy up the connections. But basically, I started with 3D printing because I wanted to make boxes for gadgets. And what I've discovered is that actually it's kind of fun, because you can go on to places like Thingiverse and find little model rockets and other things, and you can make stuff. And I think the next version of the Kinect toolkit is going to have a thing where you can basically wave the sensor around and it'll build a 3D model. They're talking about this. And if that's the case, it means that for Christmas, I could give all my family a little statue of me for the mantelpiece. Now, that or the dartboard. I mean, it would. It's just. And why on earth not? Why would you not want to do that? So, if you. I don't know whether in the future everyone will have their own 3D printer. I don't really care. Because I'm having fun playing with the one that I've got. But what I have found is that it's kind of interesting the way the gadgeteer people have gone and thought, okay, gadgets need boxes. Boxes we can print. Let's make it easy to do that. What I would say is if you are interested in getting a device like this off the ground and you want to actually convince your boss to actually fund you or send you off to actually make this thing or find someone to take your project further, then you can get a copy of FreeCAD for free, or you can use Autodesk 123D also works quite well. In fact, there's a thing called OpenSCAB, which is wonderful, because with that, you make the objects programmatically. So you can actually generate the designs in code. So you can scale up and scale down and do. A friend of mine is building a 3D printer from scratch. He's using OpenSCAD to design it, and it's all going extremely well. He's just having to change his code to change the design a bit. And so you could produce things on the fly from programs and then print them. But to get back to the plot, you can find someone with a printer, or you could employ someone to print these things for you. But what it does mean is that you can actually get real hand prototypes that you can play with based on Gadgeteer that you can use to sell your idea. And it's very nice for that. So it's worth taking a look at. I say, I'm not sure if it'll be household technology eventually. And if it is, I'm fairly sure that the cake icing machine technology is not actually the way to do it. Or some kind of powder-based or liquid-based thing is going to work better, because the quality and the fact you can't do more than one color at a time does limit you a bit. But just for playing with, it's a bit like, reminds me a bit of the old days of television where the first TVs were entirely mechanical and then something else came along and basically killed them. But the mechanical TV sold the idea, and the same I think is true with our cake icing machines now. They're selling the idea to people, because watching something appear from nothing is actually quite fun. And so I commend that to you. So have a go at that. The actual printer, I can't show you it running because we have no Wi-Fi down here, and my Twitter printer has got it uses a Wi-Fi connection to talk to the outside world. Look at this. I went into my toolbox. That's the only plug I had. that's a man's plug. That's a proper plug. I've got the size of that. If you go on to Cool Components or Spark Fun, they'll sell you a thermal printer for about £35 like this. And there's this rather sweet warning that it comes with. It says things like, please do not use your printer for printing receipts. receipts. Ooh. I wasn't going to, but now you've mentioned it. it'll do graphics, barcodes, QR codes and that kind of stuff. And it's quite nice for point of sale. The thing that's interesting about it, though, is not so much the technology in terms of the hardware and how you use it, but what you can do to actually build it. If I drop back to the desktop again and take a look at my folder on here, I have a thing called Thermal Printer. And if I open this up, then one of the things that Gadgeteer also makes it very easy to do is actually make your own devices. The people at GHI did the camera and the RFID tag and the LCD panel. A guy called Gadgeteering Guy did the printer. As far as I'm concerned, if I go back to my original program and if I go here and want to add a printer, I go and get hold of my printer and I drag it onto the screen and drop it. And then I go, connect, please, if it'll let me do that. Yeah, it's going into socket number blah. And now I've got a thing called thermal printer. And I can go thermalprinter.start to turn it on. And then thermalprinter.print, and it prints out. So I could have a thing where you swipe your RFID card. It goes online to a database, pulls down your record, and prints in hello, Rob, blah, 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 customizes just for me. So, the thing about this is it's kind of, it looks like the other ones, has a picture, has a little light, wires up to there. The nice thing is that's all done from within the Gadget framework. What you do, if you want to make a new device, is you make a different project type, which is a Gadgeteer device, and then having done that, you drop into here the actual code that makes it work. This is the code that drives the printer. Again, I didn't write this. I've just picked it. Open up. Come on, open up. Open up.
Open.
Thank you. This actually turns the printer on, and it uses a serial port. So effectively, to initialize it, we set some heating parameters. We write to the serial port a whole bunch of stuff. To print the message, we just print it out on the serial port. To get the bitmap, we effectively have to take our bitmap and encode it into black and white, make a bunch of bytes, and then push it out the serial port. This is all standard stuff. It's kind of what you do, data sheet in one hand, visual sheet in the other. You just work your way through and make it go. I then write some XML that tells the Gadgeteer framework, okay, this is the picture. This is how big it is. This is where the socket needs to go. In here, we've got the links to the actual assemblies. Then down below here, I've got the pins I want to use. So I'm going to be using these pins, socket type U, because it's a serial connection. And at that point, I turn a handle, and effectively an installer drops out the end, which means I can then send people the installer. They can run it on their PC, and they now have a printer they can use. So what this means is if you start thinking in terms of actually manufacturing your own gadgets, these bits, not just the processors, anything you like, or you have a whole bunch of behavior you want to wrap up as a gadget and deploy as a gadget, then this is how you do it. I mean, if you look inside the actual program, if we dig into the actual generated code down here, then this is what the Gadgeteer framework uses to get things going. It effectively declares all my devices. And then when we start up, oh, there's a main method. That's where everything starts. That's good. We then effectively initialize the modules, make a new camera, make a printer, make an RFID tag, and they're all given the number of the socket they've been pushed into, and off we go. So you can unpick this, and none of it's rocket science, because that's science about rockets. So you can see how it all fits together, and it's all very lightweight, but in terms of actually the potential that there is for thinking, so if you come up with a new interface and you think, I want to deploy that on my Gadgeteer devices, okay, build the hardware up, get a cable and a connector. One of the things I use in the Twitter printer, because I have to, is there's a little takeaway connector, which is basically a socket and a row of pins that I can then solder onto. So if you have a servo or a thing you want to control that you don't have a driver for, write one, package it up, and then either sell it or push it out there for free. So you've got lots of lovely directions you can travel in to actually make not just devices out of the gadgets, but interfaces for the gadgets as well. And so if there is a thing you need that isn't covered by the gadgeteer, then you can actually get the hardware from somewhere, build it up, and then build your own drivers, and off you go. It really is, I'm not saying the sky's the limit, but there's a lot of scope here for taking ideas and pushing them into the framework and then making that available for other people to use. You see this in terms of how it's being used and what people are doing with it, and folk like this knocking out the printer drivers and things, which make it a lot easier for everybody else. So that's kind of good. So in terms of where we're at and the end point of the talk, we're talking about embedded devices. We're talking about putting control software in to make them do stuff. And we're talking about using C# and Visual Studio to do that. Don't forget, you can use VB. If you make a new VB, you can actually put VB in here. As far as the system's concerned, it's running the bytecodes, and they come out of the compiler. You could probably use other languages, but you'd have to do some fairly interesting tweakage to make that go. There's all kinds of ways you can go with this. Huge range of interfaces. We can make programs that wake up and do stuff or go to sleep for a while. Some of the devices have got real-time clocks on them, which are battery backed up. Or not, depending on the platform that you go for. There's a whole range of different screen sizes. You've got OLED and other technologies as well, should you wish to do that. You can use a 3D printer if you fancy producing a case, and that's kind of fun. That's a nice piece of hobby expenditure, I guess. In terms of useful stuff, I'll put these slides up on robmiles.com. Okay, fair enough. You went first. You're supposed to go woo when I say that, but you didn't know that, so why do I mention it? But there's basically Ultimaker do the printers. So FreeCAD is good. 123D is good. That one is, if you're of an artistic bent, see, all I wanted to do was make some square boxes like this, which is not artistic, but doesn't half hold the product well. And so I go into what 123D. And that lets you do bevels and embossing, and you can put text. One thing I did do with 123D, I put some text, actually embossed some text into the lid, which kind of worked, although I needed to have another go at that to improve the quality. But this one's kind of good for just designing objects, and this one's kind of good for just designing stuff. This one also, if you want to, you can write your own Python modules and plug them in. So you can effectively programmatically produce designs in that one as well. But OpenSCAD is a better way of doing that because I found the API a bit easier to use. GHI is a company that makes a lot of gadgeteer stuff, but not all of it. But they're a good starting point. And the gadgeteer website is up here as well. So it's just great fun. What I'm kind of hoping will happen after this talk is if you've got an idea for an embedded thing that would be really useful at work or at play or whatever, but you can't figure out how the heck to get started and what on earth I could do to actually get that to go and how I'd have to put the code in, then what I want you to take away from this is the thought that actually, if I have a look at Gadgeteer, there's a good chance that there'll be a way in which I can actually do this quite easily and prototype it without too much effort, but with the endpoint that you can take these designs and just effectively mass produce them as a single unit. A friend of mine has got very into it quite recently, and he's talking about buying individual ARM chips and actually putting the code into them himself. You can do that because it's open source, and in fact his plan is to basically have a custom build for his own hardware, because his concern is that he wants to be able to sell these things into the future a long way in case other companies go bust or stop making them or whatever. And so if he has his own control of the production process, he'll be fine. And if he does that, he can write his own embedded C. So if he does find the bit that needs to go really fast, he can write that in C and drop it in as a library and call that from the C# in the Gadgeteer code at the front. So it's actually quite an interesting way to explore an embedded world, which is also extremely connected. Before we go any further, any questions, folks? Yeah? Generally speaking, it tends to go on embedded ARM chips, the smaller ones. If you go on to the porting kit, it gives you a list of the processor types if you're going to the Gadgeteer site. But they tend to be the smaller ARM ones. They've usually got about 128 meg or so of program code. I can't recall. They're big enough for what I've done, if that helps. But they're a range of different sizes and performances. The teeny tiny one has an 18 meg clock. It's fairly slow, but it's very, very small and very low power consumption. You can use that for logging and things. So there's a whole range of different processors. It's not a very good answer, but it's kind of where I am. Yeah?
Does it support watchdogging?
The question is, does it support watchdogging? that sounds like a disgusting practice. Does everyone here know what watchdogging is? All the hands go over the back. Yes, right, fine. Do you really know what watchdogging is? Let me show. No. A watchdog, for those of you, it's basically a hardware thing that kicks the device if something really bad happens. If your program locks up because the software has got stuck, a watchdog is effectively a piece of hardware that will knock it back into a known good state. Is that a fair comment? There's no watchdogging built in as such. You could manufacture one of your own because you could basically hit the reset line. What you do is your program, when it's running, does this to a signal, and your watchdog is looking in hardware for a thing that does that. And as soon as that stops happening, the watchdog fires the reset and knocks your program back to a known good state. As far as I'm aware, there's no formal mechanism for watchdogging built in. Although if your processor has got it, you could probably do a custom build that has that as part of it as well. So you could target a processor that has a watchdog and add your own behaviors in to make that the case. And then bind it however you like to do a warm start, whatever you want, when you get the event. I mean, in my experience, it's pretty solid. I've made Twitter Printer and left it running for a couple of days. And it just keeps going. It does all the wonderful garbage collection type stuff, which is nice. It's proper .NET. If you watch my programs run occasionally, the garbage collection runs past. It isn't a particularly fast one. But it gets the job done. If you design your applications properly, you shouldn't have much garbage anyway. If you don't create and destroy objects too much, then it'll all behave itself quite nicely. But the need for a watchdog in these kind of, I haven't actually seen that, but it's a good question. At the back, yeah? The extra components, if you go on the GHI site, they give you a price for each of them. The buttons are about £2 or £3. The LCD panels come in at around 20. The joystick adapter, there's a joystick, I didn't mention that. That's about a fiver. The most expensive one, I think, is, I don't know quite know why, but it is the VGA adapter, which is about £75. The Wi-Fi one is stupidly expensive as well, at about 60, which is very annoying. But it's basically a proprietary one that they've remounted onto a carrier of their own. They kind of range from about £5 to about £30, depending on which one you go for. You could buy one or two a week, pocket money prices type thing, and then build up a collection, which is kind of nice. The soil thing's actually very cheap. I thought it's about £3, I think. So you can just work your way through, got to catch them all kind of thing. Any other questions? No more hands. Okay, right. Well, thank you for being a splendid audience. And I've given you 7 minutes of your life back. You. If you want to come and fondle any of my pink stuff, then by all means, come and take a look.